Sunshines and seasons and streams, like our dreams, come and go. But here's the peace in our lives that survives.
Father! Happy Sabbath. I've been reading from Luke chapter 10, verse 24. And it says, "For I tell you that many prophets and kings have desired to see what you see, and have not seen it, and to hear what you hear, and have not heard it." Thank you.
Good morning. I should switch my microphones here. Let's do that. Take just a moment to get the technologizing. It is fun to be back at Three Angels. And I was thinking about it. Now we're going to hopefully get this up on the screen here. I've spent more Sabbaths in this church than anywhere else on earth. So it's nice to be back. It has been just over 6 years since my wife and I moved to Canada to care for her parents, and that was a blessed experience. It was a blessing in many ways. Her mother passed away about 15 months ago, and her father passed away about 2 months ago now. And so once again, we're kind of in a stage of transition, which basically is, I'm pretty comfortable with that because I hardly ever know what I'm doing anyhow. So, so don't ask, because I don't know. But anyhow. But I'm here today, and I'm happy to be here today, and I'm happy to have the chance to share what I personally think is one of the most compelling, important elements of our Seventh-day Adventist Church history. Now, for those of you who may not know me, or just don't know or care, but I'm kind of an Adventist historian. I just have always been blessed by a study of our past, and you know it doesn't just stay with history, because as a people we're more than just what we used to do. As a people, we're what God wants us to do yet. And so you can't deal with Adventist history without tangling with theology and eschatology and, you know, all that other stuff. And I like this particular topic because out of all the elements of our church history, I would argue that this is the one that probably makes us most distinctive from all other Christian groups. Now, I know there are people who would argue with that, and that's perfectly fine. My opinion is not sacred, so you know, feel free to argue with anything that I say. You know, oftentimes when we look at our distinctive doctrines, you know, well, there are other people who understand the state of the dead. There are other people who expect a second coming. There are other folks who keep the Sabbath. And we look at, and one thing that we point to commonly, we point to the sanctuary, and we say the sanctuary is unique, and it is. And yet I would argue that the sanctuary, without what I'm going to be talking today, would just be kind of, yeah, what do you do with it? So let's go back and let's start March 14, 1858. This was a Sunday afternoon at the funeral of a local school in a local schoolhouse in Lovett's Grove, Ohio. The building was full. People were standing outside. James White gave the funeral address, and after he spoke, his wife Ellen White stood up to speak, and as she was speaking, she was taken off into vision. With a full schoolhouse full of people and others standing around outside, she was envisioned for 2 hours, and all the normal, you know, normal side effects, you know, of supernatural strength and not breathing and, you know, other minor details like that were apparent on that occasion, and quite a number got to see that. It's It's quite a trick to hold your breath for 2 hours. Made a bit of an impression. Well, Ellen White wrote this. In the vision at Lovett's Grove, most of the matter which I had seen 10 years before concerning the great controversy of the ages between Christ and Satan was repeated, and I was instructed to write it out. So, you may have guessed already, the topic that I want to spend time on this morning is actually the context of everything Christian, the great controversy, the understanding of what's going on behind the scenes. I would argue, and you can argue differently, that's fine, no hard feelings, but I would argue that without that understanding of the great controversy, most everything else that we hold to, and especially those things that we hold distinctive, would just kind of be, you know, what do you do with it? Well, okay, so this little statement is kind of interesting for a couple of reasons. Perhaps the least important of those reasons is nobody really knows what she's talking about when she says 10 years before. Ah, this is 1858, you go 10 years back, that's 1848. But, you know, we don't have any record of her having a vision on the Great Controversy in 1848. There is one. Is in August, late August, 1848, in Hannibal, New York, where she had a vision that lasted for an hour and a half. But you know what? She didn't say much or write much about that vision. And so it's possible that that longer vision was when she's referring to 10 years before. But she wasn't told to write it out. And she didn't. Or it's possible that what she's talking about is, you know, just little dips and dabs, you know, through a number of visions over, you know, maybe from 1847 to 1849. It might have been a general. Well, nobody really knows. But the fact that she said she'd seen much of this 10 years before is kind of interesting because it's the first illustration that we'll touch on today of where Ellen White was shown more than she let on. Shall I say? Sometimes the Lord gave her background information that I assume was to guide her general demeanor and influence one thing or another. But it wasn't for everybody else at that point. Well, here it was. She was told to write it out. I was shown that while I should have to contend with the powers of darkness, for Satan would make strong effort to hinder me, yet I must put my trust in God and angels would not leave me in the conflict. Well, that assurance that God would not leave her was needed because the conflict was not long in coming. Okay, did I lose something? I think I left a slide out. I can tell you what it says. 2 days later, James and Ellen were at the home of the Palmers, and as Ellen White was talking to Mrs. Palmer, she said suddenly she felt like a cold charge come down her left side. Her tongue seemed to swell in her mouth. She couldn't speak. Her left arm was non-responsive. It wasn't even waving around clumsily. It just was non-responsive. She couldn't feel anything on her left side. On her head, left side of her head, we would say it was a stroke. As she said in that account of it, she said she was only 50 miles from home, but she never expected to see her children again. She thought she was on her way out. Well, for several weeks, I should add one more thing, and that is that the believers who were there with her prayed very earnestly. And she didn't get better. She didn't come back from the dead. But she stabilized. And they got her on home. And then she wrote this. For several weeks, I could not feel the pressure of the hand or the coldest water poured upon my head. In rising to walk, I often staggered and sometimes fell to the floor. In this afflicted condition, I began to write on the Great Controversy. You know, we heard a testimony this morning of how it's good to press ahead, even when it's hard sometimes. Yeah, There's another example. At first, I could write but one page a day and then rest for 3 days. But as I progressed, my strength increased. The numbness in my head did not seem to cloud my mind. And before I finished writing Spiritual Gifts Volume 1, the effect of the shock had entirely left me. At the time of the conference at Battle Creek in June, a couple months later, the vision and the stroke were in March, and this is June, a couple months later, I was shown in vision that in the sudden attack at Jackson, Satan intended to take my life in order to hinder the work I was about to write. But angels of God were sent to my rescue. So now this raises an interesting question. Why was this particular vision so important to the devil? Why would he go out of his way? I mean, yeah, we could say that, okay, he's not a nice guy and he would be happy to kill anybody anytime type of thing. We could say that. But there was a special intention. There was a special determination, a special effort. Why this time? Well, my opinion, because his cover was about to be blown. Okay? The advantage of surprise was about to be stripped from him. His earthly enemies, that's us, were about to be given a clearer picture of his war against them. From a military point of view, you know, put yourself in a position of a general or somebody, you know, that's a huge thing. You lose the element of surprise. You lose, you know, your plans are disclosed to the enemy. That's a big issue. Well, the great controversy story that came from that vision was first written out as Spiritual Gifts Volume 1, and then it was expanded into the four-volume set called The Spirit of Prophecy, Volumes 1 to 4, right? And then finally it was expanded into the five-volume Conflict of the Ages set. Sometimes when we say The Great Controversy, we're talking about one book, right? The Volume 5 of the last series, right? Sometimes we mean the kind of the whole thing, you know, the great controversy theme or motif, some people would call it. That's fine. To me, it's really very interesting that God would go to the trouble of telling his people that information at that time in history. Now, if you had a diligent mother, as did I, you probably at some point or another were admonished, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. Right? You probably heard that. And as a general rule, it's good advice. But there are exceptions. Because it's hard to say a lot of nice things about Lucifer. And if God followed that rule assiduously in regard to Satan, we would know nothing. Well, in Scripture itself, we have some key things. Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, Revelation 12, a few things scattered through the Gospel. Working from Revelation 12, you can go back to Genesis 3. It's not a lot more than that. And so this is a big thing. This is a huge increase in the knowledge and understanding of God's people in regard to their enemy. Okay? Well, let's see. Let's go on. Let's go on. There we go. So what I want to do is I want to fill out that theme. Now let's just, I'm going to blank that out because I don't want you. No, I'm not. There we go. We're going to blank it out that way. And then we'll blank it out. There we got it. Okay. I don't want you reading that yet. So, a word or two about the Great Controversy. I remember very distinctly when I was either 12 or 13. I don't remember which year it was, but I was either 12 or 13. It was a camp meeting. And someone just committed a terrible tactical error. And the early teens were dismissed before the adults. and that really shouldn't be. And just make a note on that. But that's really a very bad idea. But nonetheless, that's what happened on this particular occasion. And so I went looking for my parents, and they were still in the adult meeting, you know, whatnot. And so I remember I went to the door of this big auditorium, and I can picture exactly where I was standing. And there was some guy up on the stage, and I don't know who he was, but he was holding up a book, and he says, "This book changed my life." That was interesting. I was looking for my parents. Couldn't find them. But he's still up there talking. And he said, "This book changed my life." And he went ahead and he ended up telling that the book was The Great Controversy. And somehow that little comment of his stuck in my mind. And a week or two later, I was back home. It was a lonely summer. Mom and Dad were both working. All the other kids were gone. I was stuck at home way out in the country all by myself. Had, you know, a dog and a cat type of thing. And I thought, I'm going to read that book. And so that summer, I read Great Controversy. It changed my life. If you haven't read it, please read it. If you haven't read the conflict set, the whole five volumes, please read them. It'll change your life. Just saying. Okay. But now here's what I want to do. Because I'm a bit of an Adventist history nerd, I want to share with you a lot of the little details that I found that expand even on what is in those books. Does that make sense? Okay? Because Ellen White had a lot of really fascinating key additional details that I think are more needed today than when she wrote them. Just like, you know, back in Martin Luther's day, they didn't need the whole Great Controversy story. They understood what they needed to know at the time. I believe we are nearer the end of time than we were before. I think that much is safe. And I think we need this stuff. So, here we go. Let's catch a few of the things here. The greatest talents and the highest gifts that could be bestowed on a created being were given to Lucifer, the covering cherub. Before his fall, he was a glorious being occupying a position next to Christ. Lucifer was a covering cherub distinguished by his excellence. God made him good and beautiful, as near as possible, like himself. Okay, now, I just want to point out something here. Notice that last little phrase there, as near as possible, like himself. If the English holds, and it should, could God make someone more like himself than Lucifer? I'm hearing a variety of answers. This is fun. I like this. As near as possible. Beyond that was impossible. Now, I just want to say that just so I can, you know, get the shock value of it out of the way here. Because we are used to saying God can do anything. Now, there's a lot of stuff that God can't do. We'll come to it. But I wanted to get the shock of that value, you know, shock value of that out of the way, and kind of just rattle your cages just once here at the beginning, because down the road a little bit, we're going to see things that God cannot do or could not do at the time or other things of that nature. He could not make someone more like himself than Lucifer, as near as possible. But just notice, these great talents, these high gifts were bestowed on Lucifer. Right? It's like when he came into existence, he was as near like God as it was possible for a created being to be created. That's not a bad way to start life. Okay, let's go on. Lucifer chose to sin. We're never going to understand why. I'm not even going to try and answer that. But after he had chosen to go down the path of sin, the development of that path is as close to logical as you can be when you're being illogical. Does that make sense? You follow what I'm saying? You know, once he, why he chose to sin, no one will ever know, because there is not a reason. But once he had chosen selfishness, it's not hard to see why it developed the way it did. So, here we go. When God said to his son, "Let us make man in our image," Satan was jealous of Jesus. He wished to be consulted concerning the formation of man, and because he was not, he was filled with envy, jealousy, and hatred. Okay, interesting. Why would that be? Was it just because he wanted to be important in heaven? Hey, you're planning stuff. I ought to be in on the plans. Or was it because he knew what the plans were about? And he had an interest in this thing with man. Satan hates mankind because they are the workmanship of God. He opposed the creation of man. Now that's kind of interesting. We could say, well, yeah, Satan hates everything that's nice. He hates the little birdies that sing. You know, he hates the flowers. You know, but he opposed the creation of man. In the normal English sense of things, that would mean before it happened. You follow what I'm saying? Let's go on. Oops. There it is. Well, it's coming. Now notice human beings, right? Next to the angelic beings, the human family formed the image of God are the noblest of his created works. Good. But no other creature that God has made is capable of such improvement, such refinement, such nobility as man. Man cannot conceive what he may be and what he may become. Through the grace of Christ, he is capable of constant mental progress. Now that makes human beings sound kind of special. God would place man upon probation to test his loyalty before he could be rendered eternally secure. If he endured the test wherewith God saw fit to prove him, he should eventually be equal with the angels. Where was man created? A little lower than the angels. Here we have the idea of being equal with the angels. And here, the work of redemption involved consequences of which it is difficult for man to have any conception. There was to be imparted an excellency of power which would place him higher than the angels who had not fallen. I am guessing, and I want to leave that as a guess, because I don't have a thus saith the Lord for it. But I am guessing that angels are, compared to human beings at least, static. Does that make sense? They are what they are. Lucifer was made what he was. On day one, he was made with all those gifts and talents. Human beings, on the other hand, were made lower, but are something of a work in progress. Now, if one item is standing still and the other item is moving, in process of time, the one that was lower will become equal and eventually higher. Lucifer had already chosen the track of selfishness. How do you suppose it went down when he found that a new race of creatures was eventually going to surpass him? To the selfish heart, that's unacceptable. Should it have been a problem for Lucifer? No, it should not have been a problem at all. If he had not already chosen selfishness, the response would have been, "Praise the Lord, this is like so cool. For the first time in my life, I get to find out what it's like to take orders from somebody other than God. I've never been there before. This is going to be wonderful. I will learn something new." But he didn't go that way. We can see perhaps why. God was a light so effulgent. Stop for just a moment. That is a certifiable 25-cent word right there. How many of you know what effulgent means? It's not really a common vocabulary word in our current society. Fortunately, it's simple. It means really, really bright. That's all it means, okay? God was a light so bright that Lucifer occupied the position of covering cherubs that the universe could at all times look upon his glory. God was so bright, Lucifer was the covering cherub. He, who was once the covering cherub, whose work it was to hide from the heavenly intelligences the glory of God, perverted his intellect and divorced himself from God. So now Lucifer was a number of things, right? I mean, he was the choir director, right? But his key title was covering cherub. And what was the purpose of covering cherub? It was to hide from the heavenly intelligences the glory of God. That was his job. Adam and Eve were granted communion with their Maker with no obscuring veil between. Do you catch the significance? What was going to happen to Lucifer's job if that idea ever caught on? Okay. Through the imparted life of Christ, man has been given opportunity to win back again the lost gift of life and to stand in his original position before God, a partaker of the divine nature. In other words, this original position, it's not something that we gain because of sin. It's like we barely get back up to where we were supposed to be. Does that make sense? It's not that sin does us a favor and somehow, oh, wow, those guys, they understand all sorts of evil things now, but then they rejected it, so they're cool, so we'll make them higher than the angels. No. The original plan. Satan, in his efforts to deceive and tempt our race, had thought to frustrate the divine plan of man's creation, but Christ now asks that this plan be carried into effect as if man had never fallen. He asks for his people not only pardon and justification, full and complete, but a share in his glory and a seat upon his throne. You may remember from Isaiah, Lucifer had a thing about a throne, right? On the sides of the north. He was never offered a seat on God's throne. But this was the original plan for human beings. As if man had never fallen. We can make it one step more drastic, too. Is Satan immortal? No. How do you know that? He's going to die. Okay. Trickier question. Is Gabriel immortal? Is Gabriel going to die? No, he's not going to die. Gabriel has what the theologians would call conditional eternal life. What does the Bible say about how many people or how many folks out there are immortal? One, God alone hath immortality. Up until 1 Corinthians 15. The trumpet shall sound, and the dead in Christ shall rise first, and this mortal shall put on immortality. You know, this is a big thing. The plan of salvation, God's whole plan is, I want to take these guys who used to be quite evil. I'm going to forgive them. I'm going to make them immortal so we can't get rid of them even if we want to. I'm going to bring them to heaven. I'm going to put them on the throne. That's a big deal. Lucifer was not into that. Going on. The creation of our world was brought into the councils of heaven. There the covering cherub prepared his request that he should be made prince to govern the world then in, we would say, planning. This was not accorded him. Jesus Christ was to rule the earthly kingdom. Under God, he engaged to take the world with all its probabilities. I think that includes the probability of sin. The law of heaven should be the standard law for this new world for human intelligences. Lucifer was jealous of Christ, and this jealousy worked into rebellion, and he carried with him a large number of the holy angels. Lucifer wanted earth. And God said no. And Lucifer said, "Want to bet?" Okay. I am in danger of going long here. I've got to be quick. We do not know why or how Satan Lucifer ever became Satan. But there are some things we can figure out. There had to be a very first time when God said to Lucifer, "Please do this." And Lucifer thought, "No, that is better." Can you agree with me? There had to be a first time. He didn't for however long. He doesn't agree with God on anything now. There had to be a first time, "Lucifer, please do this," and he thinks, "No, this is better." I want you to follow what that means, because it is so core, so central to the great controversy, and also our daily lives. In order to get to the point of saying, "No, this is better than what God asked me to do," one of two things had to have already happened. Either Lucifer believed that God had made a mistake. I don't know. But it might have gone like this. God says, "Lucifer, please do that." And Lucifer says, "Oh, wow. That's amazing. God's pretty bright, but he goofed this time. I mean, he wants me to do that, but this is obviously better. It's like he made a mistake." Maybe. If it wasn't like that, it gets worse. If Lucifer believed that God had deliberately commanded something that was not in his best interest, then it becomes all that. "God wants me to do this, but that's obviously better, and he knows full well. He's asking me to do what is not in my best interest." Right? You with me? In other words, Lucifer had lost faith in God. Even if God had just made a simple mistake, that was a serious concern. God's in charge of running the universe. He can't be making mistakes. Who could trust his wisdom if it had been proven faulty? And if God hadn't made a mistake, then it meant that he was intentionally harming his subjects. Who could trust his love if it had been proven false? This is a huge thing. The moment God says, "Do this," and you think that's better, you're walking down a dangerous, dangerous track. Lucifer lost faith in God's wisdom and probably God's love as well, but that's not all. If Lucifer was smart enough to spot God's mistake, that meant Lucifer was smarter than God. If God had tried to trick Lucifer and Lucifer had caught him trying to trick him, that meant Lucifer was smarter than God. That's the stuff pride is made out of. And now it would be easy for Lucifer to simply do what he was sure was the best thing. After all, he's the smartest guy on the block. Actually, doing the wrong thing is what we call disobedience. But do you see what comes before? The loss of faith in wisdom or love precedes the act of disobedience. But that's not all. Even if Lucifer never said a word about his disobedience, the influence of his actions told all the other angels, "You can't depend on God to take care of you. You need to take charge of your own life. You need to do what God does. You need to exalt yourself." "I will exalt myself. I will be like the Most High." God exalts himself. I mean, he created the whole universe and everybody worships him. He set it up that way. All those songs, we got a big hymnal here for the heavenly choir, and every single one of them is about him. I wonder how that came about. How hard would it be to maybe plant the thought that somebody could be just tiny, tiny bit selfish when in fact they own, you know, like everything in the universe? So Lucifer says, "God set it up so that he was at the top. That's all I want to do. I'm going to exalt myself just like God exalted himself. And you need to do that too. Take a little personal responsibility here. Quit depending on everybody else to take care of you. Come on, think, step up to the plate. Who knows what you need better than you do? Even if only it's in actions rather than words, you encourage others to exalt themselves rather than to submit to God. That's a lie. But that's not all. Once Lucifer took the responsibility of caring for himself, because you can't depend on God, right? So I gotta take care. I gotta look out for number one, because God's not taking care of me. I gotta do it myself. Once Lucifer took that responsibility, it meant he had to do whatever it took to provide for himself. If necessary, that would mean stealing. If necessary, that would mean murder. Right? It's not that I don't like you, it's just there's only enough food for one of us. And you ain't having dinner. I gotta take care of myself. That's my job. Like Jesus said, Lucifer was a murderer from the beginning. It's really interesting. You know, nobody died in that war in heaven. But from the very beginning of sin, Lucifer was promulgating a principle that would end in murder. Okay. We've seen this. I'm going to skip over time. And I don't want to read all of this because I'm not going to have time. Bam. Lucifer took advantage. They trusted him. They loved him. And so he banked off of that, so to speak, you know, and he hid his intentions. While claiming for himself perfect loyalty to God, he urged that changes in the order and laws of heaven were necessary for the stability of the divine government. Thus, while working to excite opposition to the law of God and to instill his own discontent into the minds of the angels under him, he was ostensibly seeking to remove dissatisfaction and to reconcile disaffected angels to the order of heaven. While secretly fomenting discord and rebellion, he with consummate craft caused it to appear as his sole purpose to promote loyalty and to promote harmony and peace. In his first display of disaffection, Satan was very cunning. All he claimed was that he wanted to bring in a better order of things, to make great improvements. What could be wrong with great improvements? You will notice in some of these statements, it sounds a lot like politics. It is. It is. It's the same thing. Lucifer was running for office. Satan could present no defined reasons as to why he wished the law of God changed or abolished. He simply declared his conviction that the angels would be better off without the law. But he could not tell in what way they would be advantaged. Ever seen a politician that really couldn't answer the questions? It's amazing how good they are at dodging questions and skipping around them. Yeah, Lucifer started that game. Many of these angels who sympathized with Lucifer had occupied high positions in the government of God. All were enriched with the talent of intellect and were girded with strength and glory. Remember Korah, Dathan, and Abiram? Who did they go after? Yeah, the princes of Israel. Wonder where they got that idea. Let's see. I'm going to skip that one. Let's keep going. In his interviews with other angels, after succeeding in finding sympathizers, he arranged his arguments and presented them as if they were sentiments that had originated in the minds of those whom he first led astray. And so Lucifer would take these ideas that he had planted in the Joe Average angel, you know, he'd plant the idea in their minds, he'd get them to kick them back, and he would take them and he'd go up to the high council of heaven and say, this is what they're saying down on the street. The tempter would throw all the blame of his course upon others who were below him. He would make it appear that if he could have moved according to his own judgment, all this demonstration of rebellion would have been avoided. God had just let me handle this. Satan exultingly pointed to his sympathizers, says, everybody agrees with me. Will you expel these also and make such a void in heaven? And he expected the answer to be, oh no, I guess we can't do that. And it probably caught him by pretty serious surprise when God said, yeah, I'm afraid that's what we're going to have to do. When it was announced that with all his sympathizers he must be expelled from the abodes of bliss, Satan and his host threw the blame of their rebellion wholly upon Christ, declaring that if they had not been reproved, they would not have rebelled. That's dumb. You were reproved because you rebelled. don't play word games with me. Used to be an English teacher. I don't like him. Lucifer cast the cause of his defection upon Jesus Christ and upon God. If they had not so firmly resisted his plans, he said, he would not have gone on doing as he did. Wrongdoers always find sympathizers, and Satan so misrepresented his case to the angels that he drew many angels from their allegiance to God. Okay. It is impossible for man to measure the ingenuity shown by Satan in deceiving human minds. Don't try it. You're not a match. Notice this. Lucifer's work of deception was done in so great secrecy that the angels in less exalted positions supposed that he was the ruler of heaven. Hello, what? I don't know how that worked. I just put them on the screen. That's all I can say. I don't know how it worked, but that's what it says. Okay. Gonna work over here. Quickly here. What was the big problem? What were the accusations? Here's the answer. 9 of them. I would have thought there were going to be dozens, but there weren't. There's only about 9. Angels are holy by nature and wise enough to govern themselves, so they don't need God's law. God was unfair when he exalted Jesus above Lucifer. God is selfish. God is unforgiving and revengeful. God's law is defective and needs to be changed. Neither angels nor human beings can obey God's law. God's law is arbitrary. Now, that's an interesting term, and that's really a very key point, but we're not going to take a lot of time with it right now. So moving on. God's law makes forgiveness impossible. And the last one, God's lying about the first 8. Okay. That's what the argument's over. So now here's a question. Are we still arguing about all that? Or are some of those things resolved already? You know, if I say the car is blue and you say the car is red, why don't we walk out to the garage? There's the car. What could take so long? Okay. Now the divine response. Lucifer throws down the challenge, and God says, I'm game. We'll deal with that. But we'll do it on my schedule, which necessitated a 4,000-year delay. And then Jesus comes. How should the universe know that Lucifer is not a safe and just leader? To their eyes, he appears right. They cannot see as God sees beneath the outward covering. They cannot know as God knows. Then to work to unmask him and make plain to the angelic host that his judgment is not God's judgment, that he has made a standard of his own and exposed himself to the righteous indignation of God, would create a state of things which must be avoided. God couldn't go there. God designed that a change take place and that the work of Satan be brought out in its genuine aspect. But the exalted angel standing next to Christ was opposed to the Son of God. The underworking was so subtle that it could not be made to appear before the heavenly host as the thing it really was. God couldn't do that. It was impossible. With me? Satan could not be presented to the universe at once in his real character. His crooked course must be allowed to continue until he should reveal himself as an accuser, a deceiver, a liar, and a murderer. Do you see what has to happen here? God can't say Lucifer's a bad guy. Why couldn't he say that? Because Lucifer already planted the idea that maybe God was lying. Once somebody says, you can't trust Fiedler, he lies. How much weight do my words have? This is why we don't pay a lot of attention to politicians, because they have a reputation for lying. God's purpose is to place things upon an eternal basis of security. Time must be given to Satan, for Satan, to develop the principles which were the foundation of his government. The heavenly universe must see worked out the principles which Satan declared were superior to God's principles. God's order must be contrasted with Satan's order. The corrupting principles of Satan's rule must be revealed. The principles of righteousness expressed in God's law must be demonstrated as unchangeable, perfect, and eternal. Now, I said before, there are some things God can't do, but the flip side of that is there are things that he has to do. We're not used to thinking that, you know. Oh, God can kind of do whatever he wants. No. He had to do some things. And notice what he had to do. Satan's principles must be developed. The universe must see. God's order must be contrasted. Satan's rule must be revealed. The principles must be demonstrated. Words are not going to cut it. Do you see what's going on here? This is words are great, but they're not enough. We've got to see this thing. The unfallen world saw that the character of God could be vindicated only through this trial and conflict of the two forces. The attributes of God must be made to appear. Of the stability of his government, there must be no question. I mean, he's in charge of the universe. You don't want the guy messing up. Okay. Skipping along here. No verbal description could reveal God to the world. Through a life of purity, a life of perfect trust and submission to the will of God, a life of humiliation such as even the highest seraph in heaven would have shrunk from, God himself must be revealed to humanity. No verbal description. That was impossible, even for God. God could say the truth, he could describe the whole thing, but it wouldn't do the job. This is a big deal. Without the correct knowledge of God, the human family would be divested of all divine strength. With false attributes kept before the mind as belonging to God, the human family would be the dupes of satanic lies and the subjects of satanic agencies, and he could practice upon their credulity with success. This is a great paragraph for vocabulary. Not bad for somebody with a third grade education. So let's go to line two. What does divested mean? What's that? Yeah, relieved of, taken away from. Okay? They would be divested of all divine strength. This is not good. Okay, skip down to the fourth line. What is a dupe? They would be the dupes of satanic lies. Well, what's a dupe, though? The dupe is a noun. Okay. Okay. Let me help you out here. You're kind of on the right track. Deceived. Okay. So the word comes from the same root as double or the same root as duplicitous. Right? Someone who is duplicitous has two faces. They say this to these people, and they say this to these people. And if someone who is duplicitous, two-faced, fools you, you become a dupe. Yeah? You with me? Words are so much fun. I like words. Okay. Drop down to the last line. What is credulity? A good synonym would be... What's that? Yeah? What's a more common one? Gullible. Gullibility. Okay. They believe things too easily. Right? He could practice upon their gullibility with success. They'd believe what he said. This is all without the correct knowledge of God. And so it's no wonder that Jesus came to earth to teach men how to live a life of self-denial and self-sacrifice and how to carry out practical religion in their daily lives. He labored constantly for one object. All his powers were employed for the salvation of man, and every act of his life tended to that end. I'm going to skip over the point I was going to make out of that, but here we go. Without a correct knowledge of God, people would be dead in the water, right? So the great object that brought Christ to the earth was to reveal the Father. God is love. This was the great truth that Christ came to the world to reveal. The object of Christ's mission to the world was to reveal the Father. In all his ministry, all his self-denial and self-sacrifice, Christ's object was to reveal God to the world. Why self-denial and self-sacrifice? Because that's what God is. God is love, which is another way of saying he will deny himself, he will sacrifice himself for your benefit. Let's go on. Christ exalted the character of God, attributing to him the praise and giving him the credit of the whole purpose of his own mission to earth. Dash, And now she's going to tell us what that mission to earth was for, to set men right through the revelation of God. Okay? That was the whole purpose. He had to clear up this mess that Lucifer had caused by saying, God lies, God's selfish, God's revengeful. God's got a law that's not perfect, needs to be changed. When the object of his mission was attained, another dash, and again, the statement of what that mission was, the revelation of God to the world, the Son of God announced that his work was accomplished and the character of the Father was made manifest to men. When was that announcement made? What was the wording of that announcement? It is finished. Because the revelation of the character of God was not complete without the cross. Okay? And when Jesus went to the trouble of revealing to us the character of God, he pushed it to the very limit. God sent his Son into the world to reveal so far as could be endured by human sight the nature and the attributes of the invisible God. Do you remember in Desire of Ages and a few other places, Ellen White uses this phrase, she says, divinity flashed through humanity? Like the time he comes into the temple and he picks up the little bundle of, you know, the whip thingy. He didn't hit anybody. She says he stood at the top of the steps and just his countenance is just like, and the whole place, it was all noisy and people driving cows and chickens and whatever else around her. I don't know, chickens, turtle doves, whatever. Whatever. Anyhow, everything just goes silent. And everybody stands there. And then they ran. It was more than they could endure. Divinity flashed through humanity. So far as could be endured by human sight, the nature and the attributes of the invisible God. Christ revealed all of God that sinful human beings could bear without being destroyed. It's good to know when to put the brake on. You know? You jump in a new car, the gas pedal may work, but you want to find out about the brake too. Okay? You know? And Jesus knew the limits. That's good. Christ is the perfect representation of the Father. His life of sinlessness lived on this earth in human nature is a complete refutation of Satan's charge against the character of God. Remember the accusations? What was Jesus doing? You can go down through his life, it's tick, 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 right down the list. He's taking them off, and we'll go through that exercise in just a minute here. A few more statements. That just says the same thing as this verse here. He who has seen me has seen the Father. Right? So how can you say, show us the Father, Philip? If you've seen Christ, you've seen God. And that's what that longer statement says. And I'm going to skip over it. Jesus could not express in words, no verbal description, right? Could not express in words the understanding of man, the love of the Father. He could only say, and then he quotes the most famous verse in the Bible, John 3:16. That's all he could say. He could say the most famous, most beloved, most blessed verse in the whole Bible, but he could not reveal in words to the understanding of man the love of the Father. But the paragraph goes on. I love it. But he did express the love of God in his actions. Words are good, insufficient. Actions, maybe with some words to explain the actions, now we're talking. You with me? The demonstration, the revelation of the character of God was the whole purpose of his life. The Savior of the world devoted more time and labor to healing the afflicted, their maladies, than to preaching. Why do you suppose that was? Because he understands the concept of return on investment. You know? If words are never going to do it, you want to spend all your time talking? Now, talking's fine. I do it on occasion. Okay? But you don't spend all your time doing what you know is going to be insufficient. You put a good chunk of time into what you know can carry the weight going on. Christ came to this world for no other purpose than to display the glory of God that man might be uplifted by its restoring power. Notice how he's going to do it, displaying the glory of God, the character of God. Okay. I'm going to skip over that. It would have been fun, but I don't have time. Let's go on. Christ's life of sinlessness lived on this earth in human nature is a complete refutation of Satan's charge against the character of God. Notice that part in particular because it'll come back to kind of haunt us in a bit. But let's take a look at these accusations. There's the list. God said the only way to deal with those accusations was through a process of demonstration. Okay, fair enough. So 4,000 years later, Jesus comes. How's it working? How did things look at the time of Christ's ascension? Okay, so Jesus came, he lived, he died, he rose again, he's gone back to heaven. From the perspective of the universe that had watched this whole thing play out, how are these accusations holding up? Okay, well, let's see. Angels are holy by nature and wise enough to govern themselves. They don't need God's law. Lucifer, is that going to work? You just killed him. He was innocent. You're not as holy as you thought you were. Okay? God was unfair when he exalted Jesus above Lucifer. Really? Seriously, Lucifer, you expect me to believe that? Look what he did. Look what you did. There's no difference between the two of you guys. God obviously did the right thing. So one and two go down in flames. Number three, God is selfish. All right, after the cross. You going to say that? Sorry, not working. God is unforgiving and revengeful. Same story. Not working. Lucifer, this is not going well. Five and six, God's law is defective and needs to be changed, and nobody can keep it. Now, I like to illustrate this by explaining to the audience that something that, you know, most of you probably don't know about me. And that is that, you know, kind of a spare time type of thing, I lift weights. And I can actually bench press 400 pounds. Now, none of you obviously know anything about lifting weights, or you would be laughing. Because one look at my somewhat scrawny physique and you would know that, no, I cannot actually. But just imagine that we had a bench here and the little stand and the bar and all the weights. And I did it. 400 pounds. I did it. I like to say there's a technical name for that moment. It's known as There is nothing like demonstrating what they said couldn't be done. And five and six, he just did it. Lucifer, you're losing. That's progress. That's two-thirds of the accusations gone. Now, it's true that there are three still on the board. And unfortunately, those three have extended the reign of sin for 2,000 years. Why is that? Why didn't Jesus take care of it when he was here? I mean, you know, it's like, finish the job. Well, there's a reason. Because those, well, the last one just disappears when seven and eight are proven right. You follow what I'm saying? I mean, the last one is just, yeah, it's going to evaporate. So all we're looking at is 7 and 8. Why are they still there? Because they have to do with us. The quickest way to try and explain this idea is to look at an expression that Ellen White used. She says this over and over again, 300 times in her published works, another 130 some odd times in the other manuscripts and things. She speaks of Christ as our substitute and surety. That's not a Bible expression. You'll find substitute. I'm not positive about surety. Yeah, probably surety, but I don't think it's talking about Christ. But that's her own way of trying to get an idea across. That, she made that up, and she liked it, evidently. She used it 700 times, or 600, or whatever the number adds up to. So let's look at this. The idea of substitute is straightforward, right? Substitute stands in the place of someone else. But the surety part, that's the interesting one. What does she mean when she speaks of surety? Well, it's a noun, and one definition is security against loss or damage. That's like insurance, okay? So if my house burns down, State Farm is a good neighbor, right? And they come right in, they write me a check for about half of what it's worth, probably. But anyhow, nothing against State Farm, but anyhow, nobody ever has enough insurance to cover what they lost. It's just the way it works. Okay. So there's that idea. There's that meaning to the word security. But there's a lot of other meanings. Certainty indubitableness, security, safety, foundation of stability, support, evidence, ratification, confirmation. There is the security that says, if things go badly, we'll make it up. And then there's the security that says, I guarantee it ain't going to go bad. How does Ellen White use the term? God with us is the surety of our deliverance from sin, the assurance of our power to obey the law of heaven. The Redeemer of the world in the wilderness of temptation fought the battle upon the point of appetite in our behalf. As our surety, he overcame, thus making it possible for man to overcome in his name. Christ came to our world as man's surety, preparing the way for him to gain the victory by giving him moral power. Christ came to our world to be man's surety, to overcome in his behalf, to live for him a sinless life, that in his power they might obtain the victory over sin. This is not only, I mean, there's the substitute part that kind of covers that if things go south, we'll take care of it. But the surety part is, I guarantee that we're going to get it right eventually. You with me on that one? Okay. Notice this. Fascinating statement. Every eye in the unfallen universe is bent upon or looking at those who profess to be Christ's followers. That's you and me. The whole universe is watching us. Here in this atom of a world, an earnest warfare is going on, a battle in which Christ, our substitute and surety, has engaged in our behalf and conquered. That's great. But now, you know, why are they watching you and me? I mean, Jesus did the cool stuff, right? Why would they be watching us? There's got to be a better channel someplace, you know, turn the knob. The statement goes on. Now we, Christ's purchased possession, must become soldiers of his cross and conquer in our own behalf, on our own account, through the power and wisdom given us from above. The influence of the cross of Calvary is to vanquish every earthly and spiritual evil power, and we need to know the plan of the battle that we may work in harmony with Christ. How do we do that? It's because God's people have not yet done that, that we're still here. You know, most Christians have a really hard time with that. I mean, if everything was solved at the cross, why does God allow human suffering to continue? If there's not a good reason for letting, I don't know, 3 million kids die of malaria every year, and X number of murders, and X number of whatever else's, if there's not a reason for allowing all that, and God's just doing it because, well, I don't know, he's busy maybe, he doesn't have time to take care of the problem, or, I don't know, it's kind of fun to watch him squirm. You know, if you believe something like that about God, I don't know about you, but I'm not worshiping that. There's a reason we're still here. God has done everything he possibly can do, and now we, Christ's purchased possession, must become soldiers of his cross. Time is up. I'm going to be done here with that one for now. If you can, by any means, I would beg of you to come back this afternoon, because we're going to go right on, because we've seen the rebellion of Lucifer and the response of Christ, and now the next story comes down to Adventist history, and we see the same ordeal played out again in the life of one really, really fascinating individual. So I invite you back for that. And now we will have a song, I believe. And it's because I went long,